Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top 300 trade sales through Diamond to retailers for August 2015. Trades, of course, includes hardcover, softcovers, graphic novels, collected editions, digests, omnibuses of all sizes, shapes, and forms. I mean, you name it. Whatever they feel like tossing on the list. And this is what sells into stores. I want to stress that because it's awful nice when I go into a comic store to see books on the shelf versus just, you know, empty shelves. So when we don't have information as to what's selling through the retailers to consumers, which makes this a very different kind of a list than, say, the book scan information or some other stuff. But from the publisher point of view, the retailer is their customer because comics are a business-to-business-to-consumer, a B2B-to-C kind of a industry. We, of course, the readers are that end consumer, but the publishers are selling to the retailers, and that's what determines what they continue publishing, what they continue collecting, and, you know, it's a bit of a delayed impact in terms of what we buy trickling in onto these lists. It's not that delayed on the comic side. It can be very delayed on the trade side. Breakdown this time around of the unit sales for the top 300. DC Comics was just a little over 28%. Image had 24.69% and Marvel 24.39% of the units. It looks fairly different, though, if you look at it by dollars. We've got 30.14% of the total dollars for the top 300 trades going to DC, 31.6, so a little bit higher from Marvel for, again, the percentage of the dollars, and only 17.57% to Image. Now, while Image sold a little bit more, about 1,000 units more on the trade side, they brought in $1 million less over that, actually, than Marvel. And that's because their average price was just significantly lower at $13.91 versus Marvel's 26.44%, which is higher than even DC's.
Yeah, that's almost double the average price for Image. So not surprised that the revenue is quite different there.
And, you know, that's part of why, I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how many units they sell. It matters how many dollars they bring in, because that's how they pay people. That's how they make literally money, because that's what the dollars are. Go figure. But it's so easy for a publisher, should they choose to kind of game that system. But that's why it's always interesting to look a little at both the units and the dollars and just how different the picture can look depending which one you pull. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that I really do think one of Image's strengths and part of why it's built up a fairly loyal following over the last, you know, 5-10 years is they price their intro trades for ongoing series at a fairly low price, making it easy for people to get on board. And while they do have a few higher-end items here and there, they're not as old of a publisher as Marvel or DC, so they don't have as much stuff that's kind of, you know, worth doing the $100-plus kind of edition or something.
Yeah, that's true.
Which I'm okay with, because I like the cheaper price tags. But over 20% of the dollars and over almost 23% of the units came from other publishers. So while it's a fairly cutthroat market on the top comic side for these other publishers, they've got a much better chance on the trade side if they get enough stuff to make it to trade. And sometimes they do, sometimes they don't from these other publishers. But it's one of those things that just seeing how different these two sides of the equation are, the comics and the trades, I always find that interesting personally. Mm-hmm. Just because comics are such a... They hit the shelf, they sell that week, or sometimes what they sell that day is really what matters. Whereas the trade side, the longer shelf life and the larger order compared to what they intend to sell so they can have the longer shelf life, you know, really is fairly influential. I mean, if we look at the top trade this time around, it was the 24th volume of The Walking Dead at 20,777 units. And, I mean, that's pretty staggering on the trade side, unless, of course, it's a month with The Walking Dead at the top of the list, in which case it's not that unusual. But what's impressive is not only, you know, two dozen trades into this is it selling, you know, 20,000 units, which is more than, frankly, a majority of comics would sell at these days. But it got it all kind of – that's just in the first month. It's going to do more sales down the line.
Yeah. And I think it also represents – that big number represents stores that have a – you know, it being the 24th volume, stores that stock this know that they're going to sell this over an extended period of time. My local comic book shop literally has an entire section that's just – The Walking Dead, like a stand that's just for The Walking Dead, and they wouldn't do that if that wasn't producing revenue. So a lot of these copies are probably like, yeah, I may only sell 5 to 10 in the first week, but I've ordered 40 because I know over the next 6 months I'm going to do it, and I was able to get a better discount with ordering those instead of having to order 5 every other week or whatever, and maybe miss out on some of the incentive numbers. So because if you look at it, it's almost 3 times the next. The number that sold this month are 3 times the next number, the next
item on the list. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty insane if you really think about it. I mean, that it's at 20,000. All the next items are barely at, you know, 6,000 or under, basically.
Well, the other thing that's fun to look at with a title like The Walking Dead in trade that has so many volumes out and is so popular. I mean, part of why it makes sense to do that kind of display at a comic shop is it will sell, like you said. But the fact that they do that display is part of what does make it sell.
Oh, yeah. It is a virtuous cycle for sure. I didn't mean to imply it wasn't, but I just know that some of that, like my store literally has at least 3 copies of every trade, always. Always. So even trade number one, they at least have 3 copies sitting on that thing. And so, you know, you add that up over 24 trades, and then they sometimes have the hardcovers, and they always usually have at least the first big thick compendium. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a lot of money to be kind of sitting on, but it moves for them. So,
well, if you filter the list to just The Walking Dead, and it's less obvious in this month than it has been in some past. But what often happens with this kind of a long-running popular title in trade is you wind up with kind of a V-shape on the sales, with the upper sales being at the two ends of the spectrum, the earliest trade and the most recent trade. And then as you get in towards the next, you know, the second trade and the second from the most recent and so forth, it goes down a little to where you get this kind of a V-shape to the chart. Mm-hmm. Now, there comes a point in this month, it was pretty quick with only the first 4 and then volumes 22, 23, and 24 being above kind of the cutoff point of the top 300. Mm-hmm. But having that visibility, you can really see how certain people are staying current on the stuff, and there's kind of a little bit of a lag on some of that. People may not be current on their reading, so they may wait a little bit for the trade. Hence that 23 and 22nd volume and stuff being a little lower and such. But there's also the people still coming on board at that first volume. And then again, the second, the third, and stuff like that. So you can kind of see there are people that are starting out, there are people that are finishing off. And there's that harder point for, you know, in the middle there. Where, I mean, you know, 24 volumes of a trade paperback, 6 issues a piece. I mean, that's an awful lot of reading to do. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you're a hardcore fan or something, it takes a while. And that's part of why those middle volumes just don't sell as well on a monthly basis. And in some cases, people have transitioned from the trades to the monthly comic and vice versa. Mm-hmm. But at one point, all of the then current trades were on the list. And you could really see that kind of a V shape in the sales, where there came a point where, you know, once people had gotten kind of past that middle point or whatever, the sales would pick back up in steam, which was, I thought, fascinating. So, but it's just, there's not that many titles going, really, I'd be hard pressed to name almost any other right now, that have this many trades with this kind of sales momentum behind it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're past the point of Sandman, of Preacher, of Why the Last Man, and some of those being kind of ongoing concerns. Mm-hmm.
the closest I would say that has potential, but it's still obviously very, very far away. I'm not saying it's in any way the same. I think Saga has that potential, but with it's always depending on how long the creators want to go. You know, one of the things about Robert Kirkman is he doesn't get bored of writing The Walking Dead. At some point, maybe Fiona Staples wants to do something else, or maybe Brian K. Vaughan gets out of comics completely. I'm not saying that's likely. I'm just saying Saga's on volume 5 or 6. It's going to take a long time to get to volume 24. But if there was a comic series that has that sales momentum, I mean, if you look at item number 9 on the list, Saga volume 1, another 4,000 trades, and that reorders up to 170,000 just in the direct market.
Yeah, yeah. No, I would say Saga's one of them. I think there are a couple others potentially over at Image, but, you know, Walking Dead is over 10 years in.
Mm-hmm.
So to have that kind of longevity, we're going to have to wait a while.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm just saying. And the other thing, too, is you can have an idea of wanting to do this book forever. But sometimes the sale, you know, in the vast majority of series, the sales trend is gently down. Even a series that I love called like Elephant Man sells very few single issue copies now. And it's what I think issue 66 just came out this week. And, you know, I think it makes a decent amount of money on trade. In fact, I think it has to make money on trade. Otherwise, I don't know how he's still producing the comic, Richard Starking. But
well, he's got Comic Craft.
Yeah, there you go.
He's doing lettering for like everything else on the list.
Yeah, so he may be subsidizing it, but you know they have quite a decent sized catalog, at least, you know, considering in today's comic environment, 66 issues is a decent sized catalog. But you know, his single issue sales are really low, you know, so it's hard to, even for series that are far, to say, well, they can have that staying power. But you know, of the ones that are, you know, recent, you know, Saga does seem to have that otherworldly character to it. You know, it's just really popular everywhere, kind of like The Walking Dead is, you know.
Yeah. Well, and again, being insanely popular really helps. Yeah. But your other points of both the readers having to stick with it for the long haul, but also the creators having to do it, and having all three of those things, you know, coincide in a single title, it just doesn't happen that often.
Yeah. And maybe Brian K. Vaughan is encouraging Fiona to do little side projects, like when she did the Archie drawing, the first couple issues of Archie, to maybe prevent that burnout, you know, because once you're on a book for a long time, you know, maybe scratching that itch by doing little side projects helps keep you from, you know, being like, I want to do something different.
Well, and I think that's more of a risk with the artist than the writer.
Oh, for sure.
Just because the artist is spending all of their time on the book. Mm-hmm. Whereas the writer could still do 3 or 4 other projects easily,
mm-hmm.
or maybe not easily, depends on the writer, I suppose, but some could do like 6.
Yeah.
But I think it's smart, particularly in the case of Saga, to have Fiona Staples have those opportunities to do things like you said, Archie and whatnot. And even if it means, okay, you get a story arc, you take a hiatus, you do a story arc, you take a hiatus. That's a very workable and a very smart plan.
Mm-hmm.
Builds up a rhythm. You know, absence makes the heart grow fonder, sort of a thing, for those brief hiatuses. If people know, hey, it's going to be 2-3 months to the next issue, I'm at a good stopping point in the story, it was planned, people generally, I don't think, get that upset.
Yeah. You know, and I think the other smart thing that Brian K. Vaughan has done is, you know, he always communicates with his fans in the back matter of the single issues about the upcoming breaks. And he also, I think, you know, I don't know the specific details about this, but, you know, for like the 25th issue or whatnot, it was coming back from a break. And so they did like a gatefold cover, or the cover, you know, that went onto the back of the back page of the issue. And so it was kind of like a give people incentive, and it got talked about online, just kind of, you know, after the 2-month or 3-month break, you know, re-energize, bring people back. And then also Image might do, you know, a bigger discount on the new arc starting, you know what I mean? Kind of to get the stores to load up on copies. And so there are certain ways that you can also kind of, because you're right, you know, especially comics, I've realized since I've gotten back in, you know, as a trade reader, it's not really an issue for me, because I will seek out and keep like a wish list. But for people that read especially single issues, once you break that Wednesday habit, it is so hard to keep people. It's really hard.
Absolutely. And that's part of why being on the other side of that equation, mainly exclusively, but very heavily, predominantly a reader of the individual issues.
Mm-hmm.
Cutting over to trade, just for my brain, doesn't quite make sense, because, you know, it seems like I get roughly the same number of comics every week with the stuff I read. It fluctuates a little here and there, but I've got to imagine if I got it in trade, there would be this feast and famine aspect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Marvel currently doing all the Secret Wars stuff, we're going to hit a period where all of that just gets kind of, you know, out and on the shelves in rapid succession. Same with some of the new 52 titles when those started.
Yeah. And we've actually talked about this a little bit in the past about how, you know, there are publishing seasons, you know, where, you know, maybe in the summer there aren't as many trades and hardcovers and, you know, deluxe books released, you know, and those are the books that have a lot of profit margin for publishers. But in the fall, like when I do the last three preview orders of the month of the year, I always have to budget a little bit extra money because so many of the publishers are releasing a lot of their material in October, November, early December so that they can get stuff on bookshelves for Christmas gifts. So, but versus like a single issue market where it's completely different, where it's like there's much less pressure for that. But within the, you know, books and hardcovers and things like that, there's a lot of pressure to hit seasons. And so you're absolutely right. It would definitely be certain times in the year you'd be like, oh my gosh, I have way too many trades coming out. And then other times of the year you'd be like January, February, there's not a lot coming out.
Oh yeah. January and February are always just kind of slow months because everybody is kind of having to pay off their credit card bills from having bought all that stuff for Christmas, yeah. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because, again, the big push to get things on store shelves in time for the holiday shopping makes a ton of sense. The other big spike I think there is, and I'd have to go double check the numbers to be sure, is in the June-July-ish time frame, and that's kind of the convention season stuff.
Mm-hmm.
People wanting to get those trades out so they can have them at their booth or at their publisher and stuff to sell them face-to-face to the fans.
Well, and I think that's especially true for smaller publishers who rely for their profit margin on a big part of that con sales. Because we've talked about in the past with all the discounts from Amazon and, mm-hmm. and things like that, there's a very small margin on some of these books they sell. But when they sell it for cover price at a con, they make a lot more money. So you're absolutely right that the smaller publishers definitely want to get their stuff out during con season.
Well, not only do they make more money on just because they don't have the middleman there, but I think they can make more money in the long run on those sales by kind of cementing a relationship of sorts with the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, let me sign that for you. Let me tell you about it. How you doing? I mean, just the fan having the chance to talk to the creator, that can be a really cool experience and can really kind of, if you're already excited about the material and the creator is a fun person to talk with, it can make you even more of a fan.
Yeah, and it allows them to have a point of differentiation, you know, with Marvel and DC, because Marvel and DC and their advertising and they're just basically taking up so much rack space. Sometimes the smaller publishers have less ways to differentiate themselves and ingratiate themselves to the customer. And that's one way is to be able to like, we bring the creators to you on the ground level and you can meet these people. Whereas it's probably not very often that you have a chance to meet Jeff Johns.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I'm generally not a big fan of kind of the cult of personality sort of thing about creators and whatnot. But frankly, I think for the smaller publishers or the people at the lower rungs at Marvel and DC, having, you know, kind of that aspect to how you do your own personal marketing is really smart because mm-hmm. you want to have people that are fans of you, the creator, not whatever book you happen to be working on at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's face it, for Marvel and DC, give it 6 months, that'll flip over to either a new creative team, a new volume, or whatever. And frankly, on the smaller publisher side, it's a tough market. You know, you're either going to be doing miniseries by design or by de facto, you know, of how the market comes out sometimes. You know, again, it goes down to as much as I'd like to see certain titles continuing, either they've said their piece, done their story, or the market just didn't support the book enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I hate it when that happens. But, you know, you look at how early on this list we hit around the 3,000 mark. Which, you know, I'm not sure how many physical comic book stores or things that I would consider a comic book store. I don't know how many there are out there. I use 2,000-3,000-ish as kind of my benchmark. And to me, you know, when I travel, I like to go into comic stores. And there are various different types, and I'm not saying any are better or worse than others. But if I go in and they don't have a significant amount of that week's comics, significant selection, more than just Marvel, DC, and maybe Image. if they don't have an impressive trade paperback selection or possibly back issues, although that's optional these days, and stuff that it's like these people love comics. If I don't get that sense going in, they sell comics, but are they kind of that hardcore store?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are some stores that are very more bookstore-ish and therefore heavier on the trades than the comics. Some huge gaming presence, be it, you know, Warhammer, role-playing games, Magic the Gathering, you know, whatever. But I've seen some stores that are also just pop culture stores, which can be awesome because you can find some really cool stuff in those. But there comes a point where some of those stores just don't really have that many bookcases to go put new trades on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so some of these things that we're seeing on the list fairly high up could not possibly have made it into every store in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, I'm okay with that. I think it's a shame in some cases. But, you know, there's only so many people who are going to be interested in reading certain things. And that's going to vary widely at each individual store, depending on the nature of the geography and the people around. You know, some people, university stores are going to have one set of clientele and books that are popular there. Stuff out in suburbia is going to have other things that are popular. But the fact that so many of these things are below initial orders of one per store, it's always kind of impressed me, and not always in the best of ways. But I also am not positive that everything that comes out absolutely positively has to get collected and trade and make it to every store.
That's true, especially with the, you know, with internet retailing. I mean, with the way that, you know, you can order, especially for, you know, for people who don't have access to a store, or maybe their store's just focused on single issues.
Do you think that's a smart move for a store, focusing mainly on the single issues and not so much on the trades?
Well, obviously I'm a little biased because, like, you know, I barely give my local store any business because I get such a great deal through GCBS and in stock trade, and I'm a trade reader. But they seem to be, you know, they've been in business probably for 15 years, and they have two store locations, and maybe three, I can't remember off the top of my head. So it doesn't seem like they're, you know, really in trouble, but they are definitely, like, you can tell that 90% of their business comes from single issues. It's like a huge portion of their store. And in my opinion, the way that they organize their trades and the way that where they put them in the store, it's not a priority for them.
Oh, I can understand that, because when I first started reading comics hardcore back in the day, trades were unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you had the occasional Marvel graphic novel or whatever, and then eventually you got like the Judas contract for the New Teen Titans or the Great Darkness Saga, big deal storylines they might collect, and even that was few and far between. But back issues, if you walked into a comic store and there was not literally just tables and tables and tables full of back issues, it wasn't a real comic store in some sense. Because that was the only way to go read the previous stories.
Mm-hmm.
But as trades went from what are these to they're coming out frequently to where we are now, where everything's getting collected in trade, that's been a direct cause of the back issue market kind of evaporating, and that no longer being a central defining part of what a comic book store is.
Mm-hmm.
Many stores still have them, but not the way they used to. But also, along with the advent of these trades was the turnover of titles, where, I mean, I remember when Batman and the Outsiders started up, it was a huge deal. This is the first new Batman title in like forever and a day. Now we get a new Batman title every other week.
Mm-hmm.
So with those kind of titles turning over, one, it makes sorting back issues damn near impossible. And two, you only have so much physical space. There's so many comics that have come out. What do you have accessible to your customers? You're going to have the stuff that sells. So you would have back issues from, say, the current Teen Titans series, not the five or six volumes prior to that, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the trades, pushed that out and whatnot. But it's something where I can see certain retailers kind of being reluctant. I don't say reluctant to accept it, but intentionally not accepting it. Trade's going to come out how many times a year for a title? What, two, three?
Yeah, at the most, yeah.
So getting somebody into a habitual buying pattern on a 6 to 9 month kind of a cycle, that's kind of hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas if they're coming every week because they get enough titles, it's worth coming in every week. That gets it to be part of their lifestyle, and it's a different kind of consumer at that point. Now, again, not saying better, not saying worse, but certainly more lucrative, I think.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's a, it just shows you how segmented the market can be, you know, how different the direct market reader is from, say, the Barnes & Noble market reader or the Amazon reader. You know, there's, I'm not saying there's not crossover, but I just think that there's, you know, and it goes to the same place that when digital initially started, you know, the retailers were freaking out and the publishers freaking out thinking that it would just crush mm-hmm. direct market sales. And what it turned out to be is that they're completely different customers. Yes, there are people that double dip or have switched, but they're on the margins and not enough to have clearly affected business, at least, you know, in the overall statistics. I'm sure there are, were a few stores that went out of business because of it, but it might've also been because of mismanagement, you know?
Well, and there've been a couple of cases where I've heard some particular retailers getting really up in arms about it because that big box store, that Barnes & Noble, the Borders or what have you, was like right across the street from them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can understand that local issue.
I mean, that's just a rough situation to be in, because as a mom and pop store, be it one location or a small chain, what have you, you're on a totally different playing field than a Barnes & Noble, a Borders when it was around that kind of stuff, a Books A Million or what have you. And I do think that, yes, obviously there's people who shop at both. I do at times, but predominantly I'm a comic book store, you know, consumer or whatever. That's where I tend to go for those things. There are other people that if they set foot in a comic store either ever or beyond Free Comic Book Day, that's surprising. They're more likely to see the stuff in the mass market. And I think there's wildly different expectations, both in what you would find in the two stores and why. You know, as good as Walking Dead is doing in the direct market, because of a highly successful TV show that's just spun a spinoff, that's something I totally expect to see every time I walk into a Barnes & Noble or any other kind of mass market bookstore.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if they sold double or triple the number amount of trades. I think it'd be different for hardcovers and things because the bookstores have a harder time taking up a lot of shelf space with those. But the individual, you know, paperback trades, I wouldn't be surprised if through the bookstore market like Amazon and Barnes & Noble, they showed twice or three times this number. So they, you know, just this month.
Oh, easily. Easily.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a wider audience with a wider net.
Yeah, more stores. Yeah.
Oh, more stores, and you know, with Amazon and stuff, it's, well, hell, I'll pre-order that in advance. Boom, it ships, you know, two days later. It, they've got the Amazon Prime Now stuff, where in certain areas, and where I am here in Austin, Texas, is one of them. You can get certain things within like an hour or two of ordering it.
Oh wow, that is fast.
Now, if I were stocking stuff at that kind of a place, I would certainly consider having some of the Walking Dead trades. I don't know that I'd consider having almost any other trade.
Good point.
Again, it's just, are you going to sell it that often?
Mm-hmm.
You know? But just the very concept, we're at a point where you could basically talk to somebody at work. They say, hey, have you heard of this graphic novel? Be sitting there on your phone, see it. Oh, it's there. It's cheap. I've got a, you know, Prime Now kind of a thing. Click. And before lunch, it's shown up at your office.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how could a mom and pop comic book store compete with that?
Not very well.
But if you're used to going into that store every week anyways, and you could just shoot them an email or, you know, ask them when you're there, hey, do you got? And they're like, here. They can compete on service.
Mm-hmm.
And knowledge about what you like to read and what things you should be reading. But, you know, I look at these sales figures that, you know, get below 1,000 before we're at the halfway point. And the diversity of material is a not so good thing because, again, I don't know that all of this is really going to have the sales legs to justify it. But it's also an incredible strength potentially for the industry because almost anybody should be able to walk into an idealized comic book store and say, I like this, that, and the other. Recommend me a comic. And if you had a really gifted clerk at the store, they'd be able to say, oh, well, if you like those things, this is what you should read. Walk to a bookshelf next to them, pull it out and say, here, you know, this is a wonderful book about thus and so.
Mm-hmm.
I've shopped at comic stores for decades, and I can only point to about two people, I think, that had that level of skill. One definitely, the other I'm not so sure about, but it struck me as maybe having that. But it's, and part of it is it's an impossible task because just so much material is coming out.
Mm-hmm.
you know, the fact that we have 300 trades on this list every month. You know, at one point it was 10.
Yeah, that is quite a difference.
It's staggering. So what do we have in here that looks interesting? A lot of reorder activity.
Mm-hmm. What I found two in the top 10 that were interesting. I thought the reorder activity for the fourth item, Civil War, was interesting, you know, with the upcoming movie. And it doesn't look like they discounted it at all. And it's a, you know, pretty decent size order. So, you know, getting that back in print.
I think it was both the upcoming movie and the fact that it kind of sort of ties in with the current miniseries going on for Secret Wars.
That's true.
So it yeah. And it was also like the most popular event Marvel's ever done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was one that would bounce other titles up in sales, you know, 3-4 times or something.
Mm-hmm.
So well worth reading if people haven't already.
Yeah, it is definitely a good series. The other one was actually just two down, Fables, mm-hmm. Volume 22. And it was good to see a pretty sizable reorder activity on that already. Because, you know, you always wonder, you know, with the end of a long-running series like that, 150 issues, if they're going to stick the landing. And it looks like there was enough positive buzz about sticking the landing that it's, you know, continuing to sell well.
I'm glad they did that final issue 150 there as that final trade, because it allowed them to do some stuff that they simply could not have done with the same page count split across six issues.
Mm-hmm.
It was able to have the epilogues it needed and tie the story off and be very, very satisfying read.
Mm-hmm. It will be interesting to see, because I know that they do publish deluxe hardcover editions, which are anywhere between 10 and 12 issues, you know, somewhat of two of the previous trades. But I am wondering if there will be maybe not an absolute series, because it would just be so long, but maybe an omnibus series where it's like two or three omnibus. We'll see.
I'd like to see them do something, because now that the series has ended, mm-hmm. it's one of those, since it's not an ongoing concern, if they don't manage it, interest could very much wane on that title. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 5 years from now, it's a, oh yeah, I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a shame for that to happen. It was a wonderful series. I do think the digital first series that's going on now will help in that some regard. But I mean, there's also a point of the story is over and it is done.
Mm-hmm.
But if they can find ways to repackage it or get it out in front of new readers and stuff like that, there's a potentially, you know, really big advantage on that side. One that I want to mention is just a couple items below, and that's Sunstone Original Graphic Novel Volume 3. We so rarely see original graphic novels on the list these days. So much of what we get is either compilations of stuff or compilations of stuff, or manga or, you know, other material that's not original to this format.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Stephane Sage doing it. And I don't know how this guy is able to do as much art as he does, because he's been doing various titles, including Death Vigil, which just ended with issue 8. He had been doing Witchblade. Incredibly prolific artist.
Yeah, no, I definitely where I've seen him recently, I think, is he's the Honor Harrington series that Top Cow's putting out.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, so I think I've been following his art in there.
Oh, was that him? That was, I thought, his wife, Linda.
Oh, okay, so it may be his wife, but I thought he may have, I'm thinking of, he did a couple issues of Rat Queens, or?
He may have, don't know.
Yeah, he may have stepped in when they were having issues with the artist for an issue or two, but I'm not sure. But yeah, I have seen some of his art, and I do like it.
But for an original graphic novel of adult material, mature material, take your pick, to be in the top 10 with 3,634 units, which is up 2% over the previous volume.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's pretty impressive any way you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being the writer and the artist, the guy's got complete creative control over that. So, you know, any way you look at it, he's the one to credit for that success.
Yeah. I haven't read that series, so I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with it.
Not for everybody, certainly. But, you know, his art is just great to look at. And he's really good storyteller too. I've seen some artists that go into the writing side of it, and it's like, yeah, art's beautiful, but the story, yeah, not so much. Here, again, story not for everybody. It's got adult themes, etc., to it. But it's something different. And again, I would be hard pressed to name anything else from most other publishers, much less Image, where, you know, you're three graphic novels into original material.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it doesn't happen that often.
That's true.
What else do we got on here that looks interesting?
I thought number 21, Alex and Ada, Volume 3. The reason I wanted to highlight this one is this is an interesting case for something that I wanted to talk with you a little bit about. And I've heard you talk with some of the other guys about it. But this series, I've read some of the Luna brothers, and obviously it's just one of them doing this mm-hmm. series with another person. But I've read their previous material, like The Sword, and I really liked it. So I knew I would like this. So I bought digitally the first issue of this, and I liked it enough to where I knew I was going to like it. And then when the first trade came out and then the second trade came out, then it was determined to be a 15-issue, you know, like quasi-maxi miniseries. And so what I did is I didn't buy those trades. I'm just waiting for one 15-issue hardcover. And I know that they're eventually going to do it. And so I haven't bought any of the trades. And I'm wondering if at what point are you cutting your feet out from under you? Because when people know that there's going to be a nice, fancy, deluxe hardcover Image, they oftentimes don't buy the trades. And, you know, we get into that conversation again about people who don't support the individual issues. No wonder the series gets canceled. And then it's a kind of it's the trade version of that, right? Not supporting the collected edition at the very beginning because I want a deluxe hardcover.
Well, yeah, the funny thing is it's gotten to where people can literally be in the habit of not buying something because they're waiting to buy it.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine something not so much with this, but say a digital first thing from DC.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to buy a digital first. I want it in print. Not going to buy the comic book compilation of three of those because I want a bigger, nicer format. Not mm-hmm. going to do the trade because I want a hardcover. I'm not going to do a hardcover. I want the full season for, say, Injustice Gods Among Us or something as an omnibus or whatever it would be. I mean, by that point, you're like four or five steps into not buying it because you want to buy it.
Yeah, and I'll give you another example is in this past recent previews, not the one that's coming up, you know, for our clips, but the past one, there was a giant deluxe Black Science hardcover that covers the first 16 issues, which is the first three trades. And I had the first three trades, but now I'm like, oh my gosh, I should have held off and waited for this amazing hardcover. So it's like there is a somewhat of a danger. And I don't know if it's just again, we talk about market segmentation. Maybe I'm just the type of person that really should wait for the hardcovers. And there are plenty of people who are just fine with their paperbacks. But whenever I see a deluxe hardcover come out, I'm like, oh, I should have waited.
To me, that's where it comes down to the publisher and creators being upfront with the retailers and the readers.
Mm-hmm.
If you think you're going to, if you don't know, say you don't know,
mm-hmm.
but only if you don't know.
Yeah.
If you know, we're going to go to trade, but then we're going to do this really nice edition. Hey, save your money. Wait for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I would appreciate that. But then again, that goes back to the whole, and you'll know this, in the single issues where the publishers are deathly afraid of admitting a series as a miniseries because then the retailers will not order it very well at all. Do you know what I mean? It's like
absolutely. But there comes a point where they've completely lost credibility on both sides.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, every one of the titles coming out for Secret Wars, there is no way this is going to be an ongoing where we have Planet Hulk a year from now. And guess what? We won't.
Yeah.
But you've got to reconcile the reality of wanting the publishers and creators to be honest and upfront about things with situations change.
Mm-hmm.
A good example of that is The Private Eye from PanelSyndicate.com.
It's true.
And that was one, nope, not going to be in print ever. Well, in the October previews, they've got a really nice hardcover, I think, coming out.
Yes, they do. And interesting about that, they're doing it the widescreen version. It's going to be a weird layout. So that should be interesting.
It has to be, given the way they did the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful digital book. I'm going to pick up the hardcover. I'm glad they're doing it. But they'd also been very upfront and presumably honest at the time of, no, we're not going to do it, you know, in print at any point. You want it, pick it up this way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm willing to take it as faith that they just got a really good deal and couldn't turn it down or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But there comes a point where, gosh, I got the trades. I should have held off for the deluxe version. I got the issues, but man, that trade has the bonus features, that new story that I can't justify $20 for 8 pages of story. But damn it, I supported the book so they could do the trade. Why don't I get that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the people I blame on this are the publishers. They're shooting themselves in the foot, because if they incentivize, either in reality or just in our imaginations, the later material. I mean, you're feeling bummed that you got the three trades because there's a better version of that collection coming out. But if it didn't come out, you wouldn't be bummed about getting the three trades.
Yeah, it's totally true. And I like totally recognize that it's like that. It's that I there's a psychological term for it. It's like when you always lust after something, and then when you have it, like it's never as good as you think it is. You know, like when you have this dream car in your mind, you know, like, oh man, if I ever have enough money, I could get this amazing car. And then if you ever actually got it, you know, it's like, you know, the curse of getting what you want.
Kind of the buyer's remorse almost,
yeah,
to it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the term. Yeah.
But they inflict some of that on themselves by trying to encourage the double dipping.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of why we hit sales like we do right now on the trade side, that many of them seem kind of lackluster, because there's no real additional material in the trade to incentivize somebody to double dip. People may have already gotten the individual issues, or they bought one of those, figured they could wait for the trade, and guess what? They're still waiting. The publishers have really fractured their own market.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of doing it with all these trades, again, like I mentioned earlier, obliterated by and large the back issue market from what it was. And at one point, I certainly thought the trades were going to take over as the predominant revenue stream. That was back, you know, 5 years ago or whatever, when trade waiting was really a huge factor. Digital hadn't come on board yet, didn't seem to be on the horizon. And, you know, it looked like, okay, trade sales could pick up. If enough people flip from monthly to trade, that could make the difference. We could go to a book model or whatever. Hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. Isn't going to happen. I think people are now thinking that's going to happen with digital. And it's funny because it's the same sort of story, but in some cases, almost in reverse. Instead of, well, they're telling something in the trade and it's decompressed. Well, no, they're telling it in the digital, so it's compressed. You get really a ton of story in a single issue these days if it's that kind of material. At least you can. You don't always. But as we've discovered, these are different audiences. They have different buying patterns and habits. And the publishers, by trying to service all of them, are making it very easy for people to just sit back and wait for the dust to settle to figure out what they want to buy. And by then, it's too late to keep the material going often.
That's true.
But that's on the publishers. That's not on the retailers. It's certainly not on the readers. If they give you 18 variations on how you can buy the material, pick the one that pleases you. And if that's a bad business model for the publisher, that's not your fault.
Yeah. Like, you know, we've talked about that in the past. I don't read in terms of Marvel. All I pay Marvel is $7.99 a month for Marvel Unlimited. And then for any very, very rarely, but specific things I like, I will buy in trade paperback or Omnibus, because I really like their Omnibus line. Like the recent Avengers by Kurt Busiek and Perez. So things like that I will buy, but you know, that's all I give them, because Marvel Unlimited suits my Marvel needs.
I totally get that. Having signed up in the past month for Netflix,
mm-hmm.
It's got me rethinking what am I buying on DVD and stuff and or Blu-ray and why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of it I still want to do that way, so I always have a copy. Others, it's like, well, crap, I could just go online and stream the damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Marvel Unlimited, that's certainly a viable option for the older Marvel stuff. If DC had that and a good percentage of their back stuff there, where I could be reading some of the 70s and 80s and what I consider a really cool era of DC, I'd be all over that. But they do that in a manner where I could be reading reasonably current material for $7-$8 a month, under 10 or whatever.
Yeah.
They lose a lot of money on me.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
And at which point, how can they afford content creation?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's already a problem of not being able to afford the content creation enough to stockpile the issues of a limited series enough to get the whole thing out without any delays.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, Sandman Overture is an example of that. Of course, the one that Drew and I just talked about on the last Weekly Comic Spotlight we recorded is Captain America White, It was only a 7-year delay between the zero issue and the first issue. You know, with creator-owned material, it's coming out of their own pocket. That's a different set of expectations. But if the only way I'm going to reasonably be able to read a story in a timely manner is to wait for it to be collected and see if it actually finishes first, well, there's an incentive for me to do that. There's one less incentive for me to go pick up the monthly issues. Is that good for the industry? Is that good for business? I don't think so. And again, if people want to read and trade like you do, I support that 100%. But from the publisher perspective, are there enough trades to get you back either to the Amazon website, to InStockTrades.com, or to your local comic book store often enough to keep you in the hobby? Mm-hmm. And you've got that threshold amount. And I think it can be done with trades. I think it's harder. And I think you've got a different kind of a reader. Because with a comic, you can be a much more casual reader. Oh, I've got 5, 10, 20 minutes. You know, I've got a half hour. I can read some comics.
Mm-hmm.
Well, geez, I got a trade. I got to set some time aside for that. And part of that's psychological. I mean, I can read a trade in the same amount of time. I could read 6 issues, but I'm more likely to read the 6 issues than the trade myself.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Sometimes I will sit down and I'll be like, oh, I have to leave for somewhere in about 25 minutes. And I'm like, do I have time to read this? I'll read some articles on the computer, you know, and so my reading time, you know, kind of gets put to the weekends, you know?
Yeah. It's all a matter of psychology.
Yeah.
And it comes down to, is anyone looking into the psychology of reading of comics? And I say that because before we started recording tonight, my sister had sent me an email about a study Netflix had done where they had determined off of a couple of like 16, 17 shows. I forget how many shows they studied. But they looked at, for the inaugural season, at what point did viewers get hooked? And they defined hooked as after that episode, 70% or more finished the season. Now, you could argue, I mean, to me, they're not really discovering where it gets hooked, they're defining it. But by doing that, they could find out in some episodes, House of Cards, it was 3 episodes in. Other shows, it was 8 episodes in, you know, wherever. But there comes a point where you've seen enough of it, you've gotten hooked on it, you stick with it. Now, what that doesn't tell me is if you could then take a random sampling of people, say, okay, we're going to give you, say, the first 3 episodes of House of Cards, and if you really want it, you can watch the rest of the season or not, but you've got to watch these 3. You know, is it something that, because they stuck around that long, they happen to finish, or if they stick around, they will finish, if you know what I mean?
Yeah.
At what point would that hold true for the comics? Is it just the first issue? Probably not. Nobody ever got hooked on a pilot episode of a TV series, according to Netflix, which I think is an incorrect statement, but or a misinterpretation of their data, I should say. But do you have to read a full arc on a comic to get hooked? Can you get hooked earlier than that, later than that? How does that play out? And the company that can do that is Amazon,
mm-hmm.
through Comixology. They've got all the information they need. They are the equivalent to Netflix for comics. And the amount of unbelievably useful information for the health of the industry is trapped within that data. You know, would publishers be better off skipping the trade of 6 issues and having that first thing be a 2-arc hardcover or trade or whatever? Is that going to give people enough story that, wow, if they read that, they're likely to be hooked? If so, that might be worth doing, you know? Or is the model that Image is using of, you know, get that first issue there out as a lost leader, do it at a cheaper price. Sure, people who read the comics and paid for that are going to feel a little bummed they could have gotten the stuff cheaper in trade, but that's just the first one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and is that the better move or not? Don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because the interesting thing about the Alex and Ada is I just read so many great reviews of it, and they said how great a series it was and how well it ended. And I was like, I'm so tempted to buy those trades to read it because I read the first issue and liked it. And that's how I actually sample a lot of comics, because as a trade reader, you know, if the trade is, you know, the first trade, obviously for Image, it's not this case, but first trades for some can be a little bit more expensive. And so it's taking a risk on a lot of material. So a lot of times I'll sample a first issue digitally. And if I like it, then I'll wait for the first trade. And if I don't, then I've lost out on $3 or $4, or depending, you know, if I wait a month and mm-hmm. the price drops on Comixology, I'm out $2, you know. So I have a very specific way of sampling comics, but This series has just gotten so much good buzz, and I really did like the series, and I like the creators. And so I'm like, come on, deluxe hardcover. Be solicited. Be solicited.
I hope they do that, because I thought it was a great series, and one that I highly recommend.
Yeah, and 15 issues is like that perfectly good-sized deluxe hardcover, you know?
Absolutely. You can do it in the span of a hardcover. It feels hefty, but not, oh my God, I got to lift this kind of a thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not one of these, you know, thousand-page tomes or whatever that some of these things have. There are some things I will not get, mm-hmm. simply because I don't know if I, one, I can lift it, or two, if my wrist would snap off, you know. I got bone density problems here, guys, you know?
Yeah, no, it definitely, especially some of the Marvel Omnibus, I definitely am like, when I look at them, I always look at the page count first.
Uh-huh.
Ooh. Because, you know, one of the things I've talked about in the past is that when you buy collected editions, you get a very good sense very quickly of which companies put effort and some of the resources into good binding. And so in the particular side, Marvel does a very good job about the binding on their Omnibuy. But even still, when it gets to be about 1,200 pages, that thing is really, really heavy and really difficult to read sometimes.
Well, I would worry about leaning too far back in my chair and hitting that tipping point and just go falling or something.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that you would not want to be written up in the paper as killed by giant omnibus.
Yeah. Man killed while reading graphic novel. Crushed to death. That would be bad.
Yeah, that would not be a way to go out.
But it is, you know, the point about the binding and stuff like that. I think it does matter. The physical presentation of these trades and collected editions, because that's something that, you know, when I go to a bookstore, when I was in college, I went every week, check out what are the new books, what new trade, you know, Star Trek novels or whatever, you know, that was a thing for me, you know, and when I got out of college and was working and traveling all the time, it was still a thing for me because I needed books to read. Mm-hmm. I got out of the habit at some point. I don't even remember exactly when. But when I would go to a bookstore even more recently, just the tangible aspect of a book might be enough to either, if I'm on the fence, if it feels comfortable or if it feels, you know, it's, you know, the pages are kind of rough, or I forget if it was Freakonomics or there was some hardcover book where the edges of the pages were kind of unfinished and untrimmed.
Mm-hmm.
I hated that. You know, there's a tangible aspect to these things that a few people really get at a deep level, others not so much. I saw a TED video with Chip Kidd talking about, I think it was him, about book design and such. And he was showing, well, you know, if you pull it out, you see this happen and this happen. It's like pulling the book out tells the story. I'm like, okay, dude, that's totally lost on me, but kind of cool, you know? And again, books that don't fall apart, kind of nice. I've heard stories from various people. They don't buy certain trades from certain publishers because they don't stay together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like I said, you know, when you, for the people that are more experienced in shopping that way, you know, when they do video reviews like on YouTube, there's always usually a section talking about the binding, you know, just because especially for the bigger deluxe stuff, it's a decent amount of money you have to invest, and you want to make sure that it's not going to be 6 months later and you're going to, you know, have something that you is unreadable or falling apart. And heaven forbid you have a 1,000-page book and you lose, you know, a couple pages. I mean, that would be so frustrating.
Oh, absolutely. You drop $100-$125 on something and it starts falling apart.
Yeah.
You're going to be upset.
Yeah.
You should be.
Yeah.
You know, and there were a couple of high-ticket items this time around. We got the Powers Omnibus, the Superman Batman Michael Turner Gallery Edition, the X-Men Avengers Onslaught Omnibus. $75 level, we got the Masterworks for Luke Cage Hero for Hire Volume 1, and we got the Wonder Woman George Perez Omnibus. And that Omnibus for Perez covers first 24 issues. Wow. That was some great stuff. And he really, George Perez really put Wonder Woman kind of back on the map at that point.
With that storyline?
That was the stuff coming out of Crisis on Infinite Earths, if I recall correctly. And prior to that, at least at the store I was working at the time, they sold 3 copies. Or they got 3 copies. The owner bought one, I bought the other was still on the rack. And nobody bought it. Of course, this was a more suburban kind of a thing in Southern California, you know, and the title was okay. But, you know, coming out of Crisis on Infinite Earths, you know, they went from the great Hera and, you know, the mixed pantheon of nebulous, you know, is it Greco or is it Roman? Is what's going on here? To actually having some serious mythology to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put a smart guy in the book, go see what happens. Jeez, go figure. And then there were a couple of things this time around at the other end of the price spectrum. At $5, we had another Smurfs graphic novel. I did wind up picking one of these up recently. I think it was the previous volume. And it qualifies as a trade. It's a thin digest kind of looking thing. Mm-hmm. 64 pages or such, maybe a little more. It's something that, if the binding and cover were a little different, could also have qualified as a comic just as easily.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely different things at the price spectrum. There were a couple of things that looked like they could have been pretty heavily discounted, predominantly from Dynamite. We had a couple of things around rank 22, 23, 25, and 6 of Grimm Volume 1, New Vampirella Volume 1, Complete Dracula, and Dean Koontz Fear Nothing Volume 1. That, based on the prices and the sales and how much they brought in, looked like they could have been aggressively discounted more so than some other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing like we've seen in a couple of past times where it's like, okay, this was given for pennies on the dollar, it seems like.
Yeah, where it was like a two-digit quantity rank, but like a four-digit retail rank. Like,
yeah.
Item number 50, and then retail rank was like 1600.
Yeah. Well, and you know, if you've got stuff, I mean, because there comes a point where it makes sense for the publisher to print a little extra,
mm-hmm,
just to get the price break on the printing. But then if it's not going to sell, it's going to sit in Diamond's warehouse. Sooner or later, it's like, you know, just blow it out the door.
Mm-hmm.
And that's potentially good for everybody. Hopefully the publisher doesn't get soaked on that. But, you know, retailers who pick it up get some stuff that they can either, you know, make a decent profit on to make up for stuff that's sitting on shelves not selling. In some cases, that's how come you find stuff at conventions at half off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if everybody was getting kind of the standard discount and you were seeing a lot of stuff at half off or under, it's like somebody lost money there, and that's bad for the industry.
Yeah.
See, down at rank 77, we got the Star Trek Planet of the Apes Primate Directive Trade Paperback. That was a great crossover storyline by IDW. 1,469 units. Every other store might have gotten a copy.
Yeah, but I think that's actually pretty decent for IDW for their licensed stuff. Sales
is, but this is Star Trek. This is Planet of the Apes. There are followings for this.
That's true.
This is the kind of thing that I'd be curious to see how it did in the mass market.
Yeah, because you could see, you know, with the cover facing out on a shelf at Barnes & Noble, and, you know, a kid or, you know, a dad brings his kid to the bookstore for some school books they need for the year, and they see this, and they're like, oh, wow, let me check it out.
Well, I mean, imagine a display at, like, a Barnes & Noble in the graphic novel section, maybe that's near the movies and stuff, and they've got, you know, a couple of the Star Trek movies off on one side, a couple of the Planet of the Apes movies off on the other, and in the center, that trade paperback. People would be walking by, oh, yeah, I love Star Trek. Oh, Planet of the Apes. Oh, there's a crossover. Oh, it's a comic, not a movie. But that's all right. I'll get that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are ways it could be marketed well. But it's, again, rough market out there.
Yeah, I think it's just there's just so much material now that it's just hard to. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what a contraction would look like in terms of people just deciding that they need to do less stuff, because it's all about basically fighting for rack space. So, you know, I just don't know if it's a catch 22 for the publishers. It's like a tragedy of the commons where, you know, if people didn't publish so much, the industry might be better, but if who's going to be the first one to stop publishing, and it's going to hurt them, not the other people, you know?
Well, absolutely. It's kind of that prisoner's dilemma. Nobody's going to go first.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you printing less doesn't mean you sell more.
Yeah.
To a degree, it guarantees you're going to sell less, because whatever you didn't print, you didn't sell.
Yes.
And from a publisher perspective, you got the stuff digital. It's just slap another cover, a price tag on it, and a new, you know, order number, and you're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the cost of even let's find some nice low selling thing from Marvel or DC that's not reorder activity, just to have a guinea pig to play with here. Give me just a sec to filter the list. Let's take something that we can easily qualify as perhaps not that successful. Okay, here we go. G.I. Zombie, A Star-Spangled War Story, down at rank 171. That is collecting the G.I. Zombie stuff from issues 1 through 8 and Futures End number 1. It sold 737 units.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt we'll ever see anything of this ever again. But they collected the thing.
Yes.
What did it cost DC, presumably, and this is all speculation on my part, to collect this? Well, let's see. You've got 9 issues. You've already got those set up for digital, you know, pre-press type stuff, because you did both the issues and you did it on day and date digital. So at this point, you can basically string those files together, add a new cover, and let's face it, the cover's going to be existing artwork, so you just need somebody who can spend a little time in, you know, the Photoshop equivalent or whatever. Toss that together. You've already got the logo. You can do ISBNs and barcodes out to the days, you know. I mean, that's dirt simple.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a copywriter who spends a few minutes putting together the back cover blurb or something like that. So for the cost of a copywriter to spend a little bit of time and a person in the production department to string these things together, slap a new cover on it, you know, put the title on the spine or whatever, an editor to say, hey, we should do it and let's call it this, and here's what we'll price it at. So a couple of people, a little bit of time, let's face it, they're not doing just the one. They're probably doing everything of the sort for that month, whatever. It's chump change and totally justified the money it brought in, even at just 737 units. So did this lose money for DC? I would be shocked if it did.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did it lose money maybe for Diamond or for the retailers?
Mm-hmm.
That's another question.
Yeah. And then also the especially for the retailers, the opportunity cost of having that in the store versus something else that could have done better, you know?
Yeah. Well, and the opportunity cost, not just of something that could have done better, but something that's an ongoing concern.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it will draw people into the store and whatnot, you know?
So if somebody likes G.I. Zombie, gets one of those 737 copies, loves it, that's great. What you gonna sell them next?
Yeah. And you know what the interesting thing is there is some correlation with when you have extremely low sellers, you know, oftentimes the bookstore market, because, you know, we have people who may try to argue with us about this. They may say, well, again, you're only looking at the direct market. What if this thing was a huge seller at Barnes & Noble and things like that? That can happen, but it's very rare. Oftentimes when you have such a low selling book like this, and obviously it was low selling because they have one trade doing 9 issues. And that to me is basically, we didn't even bother to think about doing 2 trades because we're not going to continue the series. But when Barnes & Noble agrees to stock certain stuff, it has to have a basic bare minimum level of sales. Otherwise, they won't even agree to it. So for people that are going to say to us, well, what if it does better in other parts of the market? For things that are selling this poorly, it won't even be put on shelves in some of those other markets.
Well, yeah. I mean, the odds of – first off, if this sells in another market, could it do better? Yeah. It only sold 737 copies here. It could absolutely do better somewhere else. Hell, you could put it on a Scholastic book fair truck.
Book fair, yeah. Uh-huh.
And give it enough time, it'll do better. Maybe not in a month, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Absolutely, this is something you could outsell. I think selling 745 units, 750 units, totally doable. But the odds of that happening through the mass market, through even convention sales or whatever. First off, it's DC. They don't do convention sales.
Yeah. They don't waste their time with that stuff. Yeah.
Well, it's not waste their time. They don't compete with their retail partners.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is.
You know, and they've got the market penetration. That's the right decision for them. For smaller publishers, damn straight you're going to sell it at the convention because the retailers aren't going to do it for you. You know, but the odds of something at this level, like you said, selling better elsewhere, yes, it can happen. But to point to the one case in which it did in the last couple of years and say, well, that's true for everything, it's not. It absolutely is not. You know, you look at a lot of kind of the mid-list level stuff, things like Lobo would be another good example, Iron Fist, Venom. Venom, not a good example, but some of these others, are you even going to find things like Ms. Marvel in the mass market stores? Some of them, okay, Ms. Marvel probably. It's gotten popular enough. But a lot of the mid-level books, you just don't see in the mass market at all. Much less enough for them to do this kind of surprise hit that people think is possible. And again, I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm saying it's incredibly unlikely. And if it does, awesome. But these numbers are much more important to the industry and to what we are going to be reading next year or later this year, whatever, than the book scan numbers, than any other numbers out there. Because the market that this is, the direct market, that is the driving force. That is the concentration of comic book fans. Mm-hmm. Sure, there are other people who read comic stuff elsewhere. Yeah, I'm not saying that's not the case. But if everybody else wildly accepts something in the mass market or the direct market, I mean, doesn't, it doesn't sell through Diamond. It doesn't continue. By and large, yes, probably a few exceptions here and there. Be really hard pressed to name any, though.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you think of anything that has just gotten trounced in the direct market, but wait, you know, did great on the mass market and trade, or is doing beautifully in digital or something like that?
The only thing that I can give you an example, but the caveat here is that this is a very different market, and these type of books do not sell in the direct market because the stores do not emphasize this. Raina Telgemeier's books, like Smile and Sisters and things like that, the Scholastic books, it's almost like a completely different market. They sell hundreds of thousands of copies in the bookstore market, and they sell maybe like 3,000 copies in the direct market.
That's a great, great example. Another one along those lines would be, and this would be from about 10 years ago, the Left Behind graphic novels that Wildstorm did.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron Lopresti did the art on some of them, and it was either Jeff or Phil Moy did the art on the others. Beautiful looking books. I picked them up just for the art and stuff. But that was something that in the religious bookstores and stuff did really well to that audience, but barely a blip or whatever in the comic stuff, as I recall. I could be wrong on that. Yeah. So yeah, there are definitely cases where you've got a property that is definitely targeted towards a niche audience that just eats it up in droves, but the direct comic book market couldn't care less.
Mm-hmm.
But those are exceptions.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and those are also things that are in the comics medium, but not in the comics market by and large, if you know what I mean. Yes, they're telling stories using our format and stuff that we're used to, but they're not aimed at us. They're aimed at their own pre-existing audience.
Mm-hmm.
Smart move, great move, and can be very beneficial to everybody involved. But I think that's a very different kettle of fish than saying that some of the stuff at the bottom of the direct market list aimed at our audience is going to magically do better with some other mass market audience,
mm-hmm.
generally speaking.
Yeah, so it is pretty rare, but there are, you know, instances, but they're very specific and very rare, so...
Oh, absolutely. And over the coming year, I would expect certain things that we're going to see eventually on the list doing better outside of Diamond than through Diamond. The Heroes Reborn stuff that Titan's doing, when that hits graphic novel or collected edition and goes through the mass market. Well, guess what? It's tied to a TV show. That could do pretty well over there. You know, if we were to see the Star Trek stuff doing better in book scan numbers, I could totally see that. You know, major property that the average person is well aware, two major properties they're well aware of. But those tend to be predominantly either licensed material or other kind of, I don't say anomalous stuff, but you know what I mean. Special, not special cases, but its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So by and large, it was an okay month. It was a little above average, certainly not a high point, but I mean, the last 2 months were better than this month, but, you know, we did better now than we did this time last year on the total unit side and stuff. So there's that. Brought in more money too, but this is, it's one of those where between the price points and the things that may or may not be at the top of the list every month, the numbers swing pretty wildly on the trade side.
Mm-hmm.
From month to month, you can have, you know, 9,000 one month and under six or 9 million, I mean, dollars one month and under 6 million just 2 months before it.
Yeah, it just depends on what's coming out.
Well, yeah, I mean, you look back at December of 2013 it was $10.5 million that month. Following month, that January, it was under $5.8 million.
Mm-hmm.
Again, January, not a good month. You know, everyone's broke. Go figure.
Yeah.
So fun stuff. I'm looking forward to seeing where stuff goes as we get more properties, comic properties on TV and the movies and stuff like that, and other movie properties getting some stuff. You know, when we start seeing the Star Wars stuff coming out, full force and trade and whatnot, seeing how that goes.
Yeah, that should be interesting. And also still a few months away for the DC stuff to see how badly they bungled Convergence, and as well as how successful Marvel's Battle World stuff is in trade. So we'll see.
Yeah. That's one of those where the trades, I think, really get hurt by the bad word of mouth and buzz and stuff of a something like Convergence.
Oh, for sure. Like, I have no interest in any of those trades. You know, like I read enough online reviews of how much of a disaster Convergence was to know that if I do anything, it'll be checking those out of the library whenever if I have free time.
I'm almost wondering if there would be some way to, and I know we've talked about collating reviews and stuff online and all that stuff, but if there would be some way to aggregate the reviews of individual comics with the mind towards determining if it's even worth collecting.
Hmm.
In other words, was Convergence so poorly received that they might have just been better off skipping the collections? Again, like we just talked about, they're so affordable to do that I can't imagine that being the case, but I'm curious. It seems like, well, you know, collect them, slap a cover. It costs next to nothing. What the hell? Why not?
Mm-hmm.
You've then got the possibility of the long tail, and who knows? Maybe 10 years from now, people will have forgotten or be nostalgic for Convergence for some reason. Or maybe with Telos and Superman, Lois and Clark and the Titans Hunt or whatever stuff, that it'll somehow be relevant. That one, I'm having a hard time believing, but, you know, could happen. So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
Not this month.
Well, hopefully we'll have some exciting stuff next time. It's nice having, you know, a big thing at the top of the list, like Walking Dead, but, you know, well, that's what makes it so fun month to month is it changes so much.
Yeah, it does.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust and needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or excuse 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and English language itself seem to work very differently there.